You've been listening to Border Free Radio with Jeff Grubb here at KSQD Santa Cruz. Stay tuned for Be Bold America with Jill Cody coming up next.
KSQD thanks attorney Ned Hearn for supporting this program. Ned Hearn specializes in intellectual property and business law with a focus on entertainment, internet, and computer software business and their convergence, intersecting content, media, and technology in the digital environment. More info at www.internetmedialaw.com. Thank you, Ned Hearn, for supporting KSQD 90.7 FM. The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America, and I'm your host, Jill Cody. Be Bold America is a live, bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to begin reuniting this country and reclaim our democracy. Be Bold America is for those who want to understand the unique challenges ahead and who are curious to learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to reclaim our democratic republic. Our future depends on it. Our program today is titled Talk Radio's America. As 60 Minutes correspondent John Dickerson said of Brian Rosenwald's book, Talk Radio's America, "The rise of conservative talk radio has changed American politics and American life." And Brian Rosenwald tells a careful and comprehensive story of its rise and its mushrooming influence. From Rush Limbaugh's humble beginnings to the election of Donald Trump, Talk Radio's America shows, through careful research and subtle argument, how talk radio moved well beyond entertainment and grievance to change the role and makeup of mainstream media, the kinds of stories Americans consume in the pliable nature of truth. We have big things to do. Before I introduce Dr. Brian Rosenwald, I'd like to welcome our KSQD in-studio community member, Mike Rotkin. Mike is a former five-time mayor of the city of Santa Cruz and served six terms on the Santa Cruz City Council between 1979 and 2010. Mike retired after teaching 42 years in the Community Studies Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where he served as director of the Field Studies Program. Welcome back, Mike, and thank you for joining us on Be Bold America's first anniversary show.
Congratulations on the first anniversary, and thanks again for inviting me back on the program.
You are such a good friend. I'm so glad you're here. And we had a first anniversary party for the station yesterday, and it was sold out, and it was so much fun. And then I realized that this show was my first anniversary, too. So good to have you here. Our bold and special call-in expert today is Dr. Brian Rosenwald. Brian is a scholar in residence at the Partnership for Effective Public Administration and Leadership Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and editor-in-chief of Made by History, a Washington Post history section. His new book, Talk Radio's America, How an Industry Took Over a Political Party That Took Over the United States. It's available now. Brian's work and expertise have been featured in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Atlantic, the Wall Street Journal, and other publications. And he is a frequent guest on radio and television, including NPR and CNN. For more information, visit BrianRosenwald.com, and that's R-O-S-E-N-W-A-L-D, BrianRosenwald.com. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us today, Dr. Rosenwald.
Jill, it's my pleasure. You know, when we set this up, maybe we didn't know that Donald Trump would tee us up so perfectly to talk about the topic.
I know. This is great timing, or maybe not so great. That's how you look at it. Well, to kick things off, Brian, to provide us a foundation for our discussion this coming hour, tell us about your book and its findings.
Well, the book talks about something that I think is a really unique political force. And it's a unique political force because no one set out to make it a political force. You know, with political parties or some of the dark money groups and political organizations out there trying to impact things. They're explicitly trying to have a political influence. Talk radio doesn't operate like that. Talk radio is a business. It's a show. You have hosts trying to do the best shows they can possibly do, and just by happenstance, it kind of develops in this conservative direction. And a lot of people in the radio business start to think, hey, conservative radio is the way to make money out of this. And they start programming more and more of it. And then it's had an outsized political impact. And part of what shaped that political impact is that it's not explicitly political. Hosts don't wake up in the morning saying, you know, what's good for the Republican Party or what's good for American policy or politics. They get up saying, you know, how can we connect with our audience? How can we keep people tuned in for the longest possible time and the largest possible audience? Because what it comes down to is if they can do that, they can charge more for ads, they can make more money, and their, you know, owners and their station managers are happy, and they're happy. And so that has a really unique impact on our politics.
Well, didn't the conservative radio just take over the AM dial?
It did. You know, when, and the real catalyst here, and since I kind of hinted at it already, is Rush Limbaugh.
Mm-hmm.
And Rush Limbaugh comes along, he goes national August 1st of 1988. For 4 years before that, he had been in Sacramento, and had been, you know, very, very successful in Sacramento. And it's ironic, because if you had asked anybody in 1984, when he debuts in Sacramento, you know, who's the next political force in America, the next big star, nobody would have ever said to you, Rush Limbaugh. This is a guy who had been fired 5 times as a DJ throughout the 70s. He had worked in group sales and marketing for the Kansas City Royals for 5 years, and he had gotten so miserable doing that that he was starting to root for the team to lose at the end of the year so the season would be over. And he went back in radio because he loved radio. And, you know, some a reporter at Sacramento Bee kind of dug around when he hit the airwaves in Sacramento and found out, you know, he hadn't registered to vote in, like, over a decade that he'd been eligible. So this was not a guy who was, like, super political and trying to have an impact, but he goes national at a moment that AM radio is really in trouble. AM radio could easily have disappeared in this moment, because ever since cars got FM stereos, you know, music sounds better on FM. If you've never tried it because you're younger and you've never heard music on AM, it doesn't sound great. And so as the music went to FM, the advertisers went with it, and the listeners went with it. And so AM needed something that FM didn't have. And talk radio, you know, the human voice sounds pretty decent on FM. And so you start getting these talk stations. And Limbaugh is the catalyst for the rise of nationally syndicated talk. He's the catalyst for the rise of conservative talk. And he's the catalyst for the rise of talk more broadly. Of, you know, at the beginning, people see him taking off, see him becoming a cultural phenomenon. And you get stations that are not all, you know, one ideology. You just get people saying, okay, this is the way to save AM radio. And a lot of people left, right, and center in the business credit him for saving AM radio.
Mike?
I wonder, Brian, if you could give us some idea of what it is you think about Rush Limbaugh, both early in Sacramento, but, you know, as he became more prominent nationally. What is it that makes him so attractive to his listeners? What is it that you think makes him so sustained and successful in what it is that he's doing? There must, I mean, maybe perhaps more than one thing, but what's the key to that happening?
Well, there's two different keys. There is one key, which is that he's a phenomenal broadcaster. He's a phenomenal entertainer. He understands what makes for good radio. You know, he's been doing it since he was, like, I think in middle school, with the station his dad had an interest in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And he is fun, and he's funny, and he's zany, and he's doing something that nobody had ever heard, certainly not outside of big cities. But before him, the kind of paradigm in talk radio was something like KGO in San Francisco, which was what they called a full-service talk station. And they did, they had every different perspective, and they might have had a medical expert and a psychological expert, and it was a, you know, huge news-gathering operation, and it was kind of an institution. That station was number one in San Francisco Francisco for 38 years. Or there was a host by the name of Michael Jackson. For anyone, your listening audience, who came out of L.A., he was, and I'm not talking about the singer, this was a South African gentleman who interviewed everybody from politicians to mobsters, and he leaned left, but you never heard his viewpoint come through. And so Limbaugh comes along, and he's doing something where it's totally based around perspective, his opinions. It's not based around guests. It's not really based around callers. He takes fewer callers than most people. He is going to carry the show for 3 hours, and it's about his opinions. And he does it, but he doesn't just preach at people. He takes the antics of the DJ that he was, and he's having fun. That he's using nicknames. He is, being absurd on purpose. He does these themed updates, and he has theme music for them. So a homeless update was signaled by Clarence Frogman's Henry's Ain't Got No Home. And a lot of these things, make us cringe, especially when we think about them from the perspective of 2020. But in the late 80s, if you were a conservative, you found a lot of these things, fun and funny. And some of them, a couple of the stations did market research and found that the quarter of his audience was liberal. People who just tuned in and thought it was funny and entertaining. And the one thing you could be sure of is that you didn't know what he was going to do in a day. I listened to a snippet of one of his anniversary shows a couple of years in, and he couldn't even believe that he had done some of the stuff. He had forgotten about it. So he's really, truly a great entertainer. And I guess the best comparison I could make for people on the left would be he's kind of like a conservative Jon Stewart in those days. And so that's one key. And the other key is that this is the heart of the culture wars. And they've only grown, but they're raging outside of studio windows at the time. This is an era of conservatives feeling like their values are under siege, that the values that they thought were immutable and that were the key to American greatness, we're now under siege, not just from the rights movements that were challenging traditional family structure and were challenging a lot of hierarchies that we've have been exposed, but also in terms of movies and music and cultural content that they felt like was degrading and that they felt like was coarse and violent or sexual and really problematic. And they felt like the media didn't represent their voice, that when they tuned into the news at night, the Fox News host, Laura Ingraham, who used to be on talk radio, would say that her father used to hear Walter Cronkite say, and that's the way it is, and he'd say, no, it's not, Walt. And these people felt like they didn't have a voice. And Limbaugh goes on the air just wanting to do a good show, just wanting to entertain. He says people tune in for three reasons: entertainment, entertainment, entertainment. And people start calling in and saying, thank God you're on the air, Rush. We finally have a voice, someone to speak for us, someone to stick up for us, someone to say the things that we might be thinking, but we feel like we can't say without being accused of being some sort of bigot. And that is the other key, is that these people felt like they had no media for themselves, and they gravitate towards this show, and it becomes a huge hit.
So, Brian, how does Rush Limbaugh move from entertainment? I guess you partially answered this question with people seeming to identify with him, from being an entertainer to receiving the Medal of Freedom.
Well, to be clear, he was always conservative. The fun and the zaniness, the tactics of the DJ that he applied to a long-form talk show was in service of the values he learned at the dinner table from his dad's sermons at home in Missouri. He had grown up in a conservative household, and while he hadn't voted and wasn't particularly political when he starts doing this kind of show, his values are reflected in what he's saying. So that's the first key, is that he's always conservative. Even his funniest bits that you watch now and you say, God, this is really funny, reflect his conservative values. He did a soap opera, the old primetime miniseries that was on three nights three nights during a week that they would hype a lot during sweeps months on TV. He did one he called Gulf War One, and you have an announcer voice laying out the whole cast, and it was really funny. Betty White plays Barbara Bush, things like that. But if you look more deeply, it reinforces conservative values, because the conservative Republicans in this miniseries, people like President George H.W. Bush, are played by tough, manly, leading Hollywood Hollywood actors, and liberals are emasculated or are otherwise undermined. And so you see this kind of thing. So that's the first key. And you kind of hinted at the second one, which is all these people call in, and as they're saying, you know, we finally have a voice, someone's finally speaking for us, he felt like he had more of a responsibility. He felt like he needed to represent the values of those people, and he needed to inform them, and that there was a greater responsibility. You know, he just couldn't purely have fun. And I think some of it was also helped along by advertisers who were skittish about some of his zanier bits because they crossed the line. And at the time, you know, we might say, well, he's gotten into a lot of trouble in the last decade with some of what he said. You know, even in the week or almost 2 weeks since he got the Medal of Freedom, he's gotten himself in trouble. But what you have to remember is at the time, if we're talking about the early 90s, there was no streaming. There was no Media Matters or watchdog groups. The only people who heard Rush Limbaugh at the time were people tuning in on the AM station in their area who wanted to hear him. And those audiences tended not to be offended by most of what he was saying. So it was kind of safer to offer more political analysis than doing, you know, for example, he did collar abortions, where he'd play a vacuum cleaner sound effect and screaming as he was hanging up on the collar.
Brian, hold that thought, because I want to hear more about that.
Okay.
I need to go to a break. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And tonight, Sunday following later this evening at 7:30, is The Cutting Edge, hosted by Nada Milkovich. This week's Cutting Edge features David Hausler, who is a biomolecular engineer and director of the UCSC Genomics Institute. In part two of this interview, Hausler shares more of his insights about broad spectrum of subjects from the evolution of the brain, consciousness, and to bioethics. This Sunday at 7:30 p.m. for this special edition of The Cutting Edge on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station. And today we're speaking with Dr. Brian Rosenwald, author of Talk Radio's America, How an Industry Took Over a Political Party That Took Over the United States. And in the studio with me is Mike Rotkin, five-time mayor of the city of Santa Cruz and six-term city council member. Okay, Brian, what about this political abortion? Tell me more about that.
Okay, so he's aborting these callers. You know, somebody calls in, and people were calling in and volunteering for this. And he's playing, like, a vacuum cleaner sound effect and screaming in the background as he's hanging up on them. And he only did this for a few weeks because there was a lot of outrage. And his whole point was that people were more outraged by that than by the practice of abortion. And, you know, it was a kind of thing that was really controversial. And he did a lot of that kind of stuff in his early days, stuff that sounds especially bad in, you know, by 2020 standards, and I think that, you know, some of his advertisers felt like just talking about politics was a lot safer than that. There's going to be no blowback on their company. And so between that and his greater sense of responsibility, and he said in the last decade, he will reflect usually when he has a big anniversary. And he has said, you know, people ask me why I don't do a lot of that stuff, and he said, because it wouldn't feel right to me now. You know, he's 69 years old. He was, if I'm doing, you know, quick math right, he was like 38 when he goes national, and basically he's kind of saying some of these hijinks were kind of a younger man's thing, and it wouldn't fit what I feel now. And he still does voices. He'll do a Trump impersonation. You know, he still plays around. He's still kind of lighthearted, and I think that part of the reason he's sort of amused, and his followers and listeners are kind of amused when he does spark outrage, is that they know that a lot of what he said is with tongue planted firmly in cheek, that he's just playing around. He's having a good time. He knows that the left is going to get angry and upset and outraged about what he's saying, and he's just sort of there's a certain playfulness to him that does animate what he's trying to do, even to this day. But he, you know, he's both a consummate showman, a consummate entertainer, and he has become a big political analyst and a political voice. And I guess the sort of last piece of answering your question about, you know, how did he go from being a failed DJ to getting the Medal of Freedom is that he he's got this huge influence. There is no person who is more influential on the right, with the possible exception of Donald Trump right now, than Rush Limbaugh. He has the biggest audience in talk radio. He is the guy whose show shapes what the other hosts are talking about, you know, later in the day or the next morning or on Fox at night, because they're listening. They're paying attention. You know, what did Rush say? If Rush says something negative about a Republican congressman or senator, the phones light up in their office, and it's not a very good day for their staffers. They know it very quickly that Rush is not happy. And he and his brethren, really, in this business, become the most influential voices with the small segment of the electorate that shows up and votes in Republican primaries. And politicians have to pay attention to what he's saying, because if a guy like Rush, or in a lot of cases, if your local host, your local Rush, goes off on you, because the local host can talk about you every day for 6 months, you really have to be worried if you're a Republican, because they have forged this intense bond with their audiences. These are people who, you know, they're on 2-3 hours a day, and some of their listeners spend more time with their favorite hosts than they do with their spouses. You know, somebody who's driving a truck or working in a shop where they've got it on in the background. They're spending a lot of time, and when a host says, you know, Congressman Jones, he's not one of us, or he's betrayed us or something, this is really impactful. And so, you know, politicians have to pay attention, and they, you know, pay attention to this, and it builds its political power over 30 years.
You know, Mike, over time, the left in this country, speaking broadly, the progressive movement in this country, challenged a number of sort of set relationships that people had, particularly around issues of gender and race, and perhaps even more around gender. And Rush certainly takes off on that stuff. I can't claim to be a total Rush listener, but I've listened to several of his programs because I was always curious on how it is that he's been so successful. So to some extent, it's inevitable that the challenge that's being made by the left to the way people have thought and lived their lives is unsettling to them. And they like someone who comes along and says, you know, you're not racist because you think, you know, white people are better than black people or something. But to some extent, an awful lot of the stuff that Limbaugh and other hosts like him do have to do with political correctness, the point at which the left's gone beyond actually struggling in a, you know, significant way to change racial relations or gender relationships, but actually often, you know, looking for a certain kind of perfection or sort of pushing things to the ultimate logic that does in fact seem absurd to most Americans, and often even to some people on the left. And I think to some extent the left bears some of the responsibility for having created you can't change. If you're going to struggle to change stuff, you're going to have a backlash, you're going to have a reaction. There's nothing you can do about that except keep on moving forward and hope that you'll be successful. But to a certain extent, when you sort of just throw up these soft pitches of kind of stupid comments that seem like any kind of mention of sex is bad, for example, when most people, you know, like to think that it's not bad to think, have a thought about sex, or to find women attractive for a guy or something. To some extent, people have pushed the logic of the left positions to a point that it makes it pretty easy for someone like Rush to make fun of it and to find support from his listeners. Do you think that there's some extent to which Rush was made more successful, or we had a bit, that the left itself plays a role in creating the possibility of this kind of right-wing critical view of the kind of political correctness that the left sort of finds itself moving into in the 1970s and 80s?
I think that's absolutely correct. You know, I had one host say to me, he said, my audience is largely the type of guy whose wife is always angry at him, his boss is always angry at him, his kid treats him like he's an ATM, and is always saying, Dad, you know, you can't say that. And, you know, when we think about these people, look, it is incontrovertible as a historian that a lot of things in this country needed to change, that the kind of golden era that is not just rhapsodized when Donald Trump says, make America great again, but, you know, Ronald Reagan used this, one of his slogans was, let's make America great again. And the reason that resonates is that folks have a very fond opinion, especially white men, of sort of 1950s America, not just the race and gender elements, but also the culture of it, that it felt like a kinder, gentler time. And there's a whole analysis, you know, we could do a whole show on that. But what happens is these movements come along, and political correctness, especially especially, and it changes the norms and the rules. And all of a sudden, these people aren't sure that that joke that they've been telling for 20 years is still allowed. They're not sure what they can say. The lines have changed. No one consulted them, and they're not sure what they can say or they can't say. All of a sudden, people are kind of looking at them funny when they say something, and they're frustrated. And these hosts come along, and they say things that these audience members are feeling. They say things that these audience members are frustrated about, and they're doing it in an even more in-your-face and absurd and over-the-top kind of way because they're showmen. And these people are kind of listening to the radios, pumping their fists, saying, yeah, you go, you say that. And then when the sort of kings of political correctness or the police, political correctness police, so to speak, come along and say, oh my God, this host said that, you know, they should be fired, they can't say that. The host says, oh, you know what? Not only did I say it, but I'll say it again, or I'll say something even more extreme. And these people feel like finally somebody's fighting back, that they have these champions who've come along, and they're saying things that, for those of us, you know, on the left or in the center, or who are scholars, are kind of cringing and saying, well, you shouldn't be saying this. It's racist, it's sexist, it's problematic, it's hurtful, all these things. They're feeling like, hey, finally somebody's sticking up for us. And one thing that they felt is that you couldn't run down any group in America except sort of white male Christian, you know, and that, or at the very least Christians. And they finally feel like these hosts come along and are kind of, you know, saying, hey, let's turn the tables. They don't want to hear, well, the reason these rules, you know, developed is because there were advantages and there were, you know, implicit biases built in things. They don't want to hear that. And, you know, we've seen it more intensely in the last, you know, I'd say 5 years, 5 to 7 years, with things that have now been dubbed, you know, cancel culture. But it was certainly been brewing for 30 or 40 years. And when you look at some of the work that political scientists have done on this stuff, where they've actually interviewed listeners, you get a lot of this as, you know, I can't say what I'm thinking. You know, even my brother tells me I'm a racist, or my wife, or I'm a sexist, or I'm a bigot of this type. And what they're listening for is that they're going to the neighborhood bar where they can, you know, say, where other people are going to say what they think, and they know it's kind of their own little safe space, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, just real quickly, I remember sitting in a locker room in the early 70s, like 72 or 3, and somebody in the locker room says, well, I got to go home to the old lady. And whereas one could point out with a careful analysis that there's assumptions there about the person feeling, you know, are you saying that you're trapped in your marriage, or that somehow you're being oppressed by the fact that you, like, actually do you not want to go home? And why do you put it in that negative way? You're just saying, I'm going to go home to my partner, but you put in this, I gotta go home to the old lady. Like, what a bummer. Otherwise I could hang out with you. But the way it's delivered, another guy in the locker room says, like, you know, it just goes off on the guy. Oh, you can't. I mean, it was a feminist guy in the locker room saying, you can't say something like that. That is, like, totally oppressive to your wife and all women in society. And the guy's just like, he was just going to make this little, what he thought was a throwaway comment, didn't mean much by it. And you can see where if somebody on a talk show were to say afterwards, you know, this, the idea that you have to say, be totally correct in the way you speak about your relationship with your wife. You can't ever make a throwaway comment like that. They would just think the person's over the top, and if you find a way to make a joke about it or make clear that it was over the top, you're gonna find support for that view, I think.
Absolutely, and people, you know, they're feeling this acutely, and they don't really see it being expressed by anyone in the media. And these hosts come along, and they're, you know, I always say to people that the biggest misconception about conservative talk radio is that all these guys talk about is politics, and it's not that. It's much more the dinner table in a conservative household. They're talking about whatever people are talking about from around the water coolers, you know, at work, but they are doing it from the perspective of conservative values. And so I think that the people feel like, hey, this is a place we can go where instead of somebody mocking us or being condescending about our values, that we can go and hear them expressed and hear issues discussed from that perspective.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Tune into our award-winning morning news program right here during primetime, 8 o'clock weekday mornings, right here on KSQD on KSQD. Our independent news program offers diverse perspectives, unique opinions unheard in the mainstream media, live as the news unfolds. Tune in for Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, weekday mornings at 8, right here on KSQD Community Radio, 90.7 FM.
Hello, this is Ralph Nader, and you are listening to KSQD, Santa Cruz's brand new community radio station.
We're speaking with Dr. Brian Rosenwald, scholar in residence at the Partnership for Effective Public Administration and Leadership Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and Mike Rotkin, retired teacher after 42 years in UCSC's Community Studies Department. Now, back to our bold and impressive guests. You know, one of the things that came to mind when you were talking, Brian, is you're talking about the extremeness, taking things to extreme. But it's to what direction? There's incidents like what Mike just talked about with the talking about going home to his old lady in the locker room. But then there's also trend over years. And how do you think the extreme talk in conservative radio has affected our country?
Well, it's affected our country because it's had a huge impact on the Republican Party. Especially as we've become more geographically polarized over the last two decades, where you have red districts and blue districts and red states and blue states, and the most important election in a lot of these places is the primary. And, you know, one thing that is real problematic in America is that voter turnout for primaries is abysmal. And you get, 15%? We're, thrilled if 30% show up for a primary election. That's, a massive turnout. And so what that does is it empowers the most extreme voices. And so as I was talking about before, those are the people listening to talk radio. And what happened over time is that they had two huge impacts on the Republican Party. The first was that you get the rise of what they kind of called derisively on Capitol Hill, the hope yes, vote no caucus. These are kinds of people who will say to leadership, I think this is a great bill, but I can't vote for it. I don't want to lose my next primary. You get people who are sort of disciplined by, where is my base? I don't want to upset my base. And who's influencing my base is talk radio. I talked to one former congressman, it's in the book, Bob Inglis from South Carolina, and he would end up losing a primary by a massive margin in 2010. And this is a guy who was as conservative as you could get on most issues. He is a big conservative advocate for dealing with climate change, but otherwise, he's a very conservative guy, but he had served in Congress in the 90s, and he realized that hating Bill Clinton kind of ate up his soul. And he said, when Barack Obama came along, I wasn't going to, hate him in the same way. And he had this case in 2010 where he was talking to three people who were previous donors who had not donated to his 2010 campaign. And after he's trying to kind of sell them on things, they say, well, what don't you get, Inglis? Obama is this socialist, communist Muslim. And he said, it really hit me. This is what they were hearing on the local talk station in the district. And so you have this where they're shaping opinion, and it influences what Republicans can do. And not just the ideology of the Republican Party, but their tactical orientation. This notion of politics as warfare. This notion of compromise as capitulation and as selling out and surrendering. They say, we just want people to fight. If our guys just fought as hard as their guys do, we would win some of these battles. They have this perception of the left, that the left is willing to do anything to win. And so what you get from that, it helps contribute to giving us Donald Trump in the White House. But it also, much more broadly, leads to kind of this far-right extreme party that believes that politics is warfare, compromise is surrender, and that makes it much harder to get anything done to address problems in America. It fuels gridlock. It fuels polarization. And the other thing they did is, if you go back to the 70s or the 80s or even earlier, if you were the kind of sort of extreme congressman or senator who was really far left or really far right and was sort of a pain in the butt for the party leadership, you ended up getting sort of sent off to what I call Congressional Siberia, which is to say that if you were from a landlocked state, you'd be on the Merchant Marine Committee. You know, your committee assignments were unpleasant. Things that your district or state needed didn't happen because
you'd also get an office. You'd get an office in the Capitol where you couldn't find the person's office either. That's a whole other thing.
Right. They're in the basement, you know, where there's rodents and other things. That's what would happen. Well, in the talk radio era, especially with the rise of social media, those people instead become stars. You know, the Ted Cruzes or the Jim Jordans of the world who criticize the leadership, they are the ones who are good guests. You know, again, I said this at the beginning, but it bears repeating, this is a business. Those are the people who are much more interesting to have on the radio and sound better, you know, from you know, talk radio is a kind of emotional environment. It's a hot, what they call a hot medium, where you're connecting with people, and it's kind of intimate. And so it's much better if you get somebody who can kind of provoke emotions like that, who goes on rants and is, you know, says, hey, this guy's fighting for us. And that's much better than a committee chairman who comes in and says, well, you know, we have the Senate filibuster. And that means that we really, this is all we could get, and this is a good deal. It moves things in the right direction by 10%. Well, you know, your audience is saying, oh, God, this is boring. And so, you know, nuance doesn't make for great radio. And they make these guys who were once outcasts into political stars, into presidential material, into the type of influence where if they tweet something or Facebook something and say, you know, this bill is a real danger, that every host in America picks up on that, and those listeners and the people who follow them are saying, okay, we better call in, and we better email in, and we better fax in, and we better, you know, get in touch with our congressman, and they kill legislation. So it's reshaped the power in the party, it's reshaped the party's orientation and its sense of politics, and that's how you go from at the beginning when Limbaugh goes national. You've got Ronald Reagan on his way out the door and George H.W. Bush running to succeed him. And that's how you go from kind of their version of conservatism to Donald Trump's.
So what, Brian, are your thoughts on progressive radio?
Well, progressive radio has not done as well for a myriad of reasons. You know, I think I wrote 70 pages on this once upon a time because it's a very complicated story. But I'll give you the bullet points as to why it hasn't been more successful, at least in terms of what we're talking about. It would be an equivalent to Limbaugh. The first issue was that there was a failure to understand in the radio business that what made people like Limbaugh successful was that they understood that radio was an entertainment medium and that there was a certain style to radio. And the first people they try when they start looking for a liberal Limbaugh are people like Mario Cuomo or Jerry Brown, who might have been wonderful politicians, but don't understand that you can't do a whole segment on something and lay out a great point and then turn around and say, but you know, on the other hand, that you know, the black and white, bold colors, so to speak, make for great radio. And they are not very entertaining. Their shows are not very fun, and they don't generate listenership. And that sort of reinforces this notion that's floating, starts to flow around the mid-90s, that the key to success on the radio is not entertainment, it's conservatism. And then you later get they try entertainers. They try people like Al Franken, people like Janine Garofalo, who are very funny people. But they come in seeing this as sort of a political crusade. You know, one of Franken's producers said to him, you know, Al, what was your goal on Saturday Night Live? And he said, well, I wanted to do a good show. We wanted to entertain people. And he says, so why isn't that your goal for this? And he said, well, no, my radio show is different. And they're not, if you listen to some of these radio shows, they're not great. And so that's the first thing, is that they don't have hosts who really hit on this in the way that, say, the late night comedians do, where people like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and John Oliver are certainly entertaining, but they're also informative. They're also, you know, clearly coming from a liberal perspective. And so they do kind of the same thing. There's a little bit of an equivalent there. And there's a, you know, a book out there by a friend of mine called Irony and Outrage. Her name is Dana Young, and it posits that this might even be rooted in psychological factors. And that's kind of the most controversial element of what I heard interviewing people in the radio business, where it says, you know, liberal thinking just doesn't lend itself as well to talk radio. It's too much focused on gray areas. It's not black and white enough. It's not emotional enough. And I was sort of wondering, you know, is this part of the story? And then Dana's book came out a few months ago, and it seems to be that it's true. But there's another really, really big factor here, which is liberal media, you know, liberals have more media options than do conservatives. Liberals have NPR. When you ask people in the radio business, well, why hasn't liberal radio taken off? They say, but it has. NPR. It's, you know, Morning Edition has more listeners than anybody in commercial talk radio. And, you know, people on the left say, well, that's not true. You know, NPR is news. And they're right. But from the standpoint of this is a business, NPR is pulling an audience. I like to kind of explain it as you've got three pillars of the kind of Obama liberal coalition. You've got suburban professionals, and those folks are listening to NPR. And you've got Latino and African-American voters, and there's very strong, very popular urban or African-American talk formats and Latino talk formats, which are not really the equivalent of Limbaugh and his ilk. It's not as political. It sometimes dabbles in spiritual and entertainment, but it's pulling that audience. And then you have the third pillar, which is kind of young voters. And there's the stuff that they call guy talk, or sometimes more like almost even morning zoo. You know, in Philadelphia, we have a show, Preston and Steve, who are on an FM rock station, and they don't talk politics at all. They just have fun on the air. And those shows are also not a liberal equivalent of Limbaugh, but they are pulling those young voters in. And so what happens is there's just not a market. When Limbaugh goes national in 1988, you don't have broadcast options for conservatives. Today you have more of them, but you didn't at the time. And in the moments when conservative or when liberal media has actually taken off is when liberals feel most marginalized and voiceless. So MSNBC goes left in, you know, the mid-2000s, and you get the Air America network, which is an attempt at building a liberal radio network, and another project that launches a couple of liberal hosts into national syndication. And the reason for that is it happens in a moment when Republicans control everything in government, and the left feels the media has served them poorly around the Iraq War, the 2000 election, and they're looking for a voice. Well, similarly, liberal podcasts have taken off in the last couple of years when Republicans controlled everything before 2018, before the election in 2018. You've got Donald Trump in the White House, and liberals are looking for a voice. And that's kind of the thing, is when people feel like they're not well served by the market, new products come along. And for conservatives, that was talk radio. And liberals never really were in quite that same situation until later when the digital world gets a lot of it. And the late-night comedians go to the left. So they have different places that they go. It just ends up not being AM radio.
You know, a lot of what you're saying suggests that the issue here may be less what it is that I mean, Limbaugh and people like him are tapping into something, but the question is, what are they tapping into? And it seems like there's a kind of an authoritarian, I mean, again, not just to label it, but an authoritarianism, a kind of a belief in absolutes that, you know, again, politics, to understand, for the Middle East, you know, it's a mess, and it's very hard for even someone who reads a lot, and I do, for example, and I still, if you'd ask me in the middle of the stuff going on in Syria and up to this day, what exactly should our foreign policy be there and stuff? Well, I could answer that in an hour. I can't answer that on a talk show. I can't give you a one-liner that suggests where to go with it. And the same thing happens around, say, local politics in Santa Cruz here or other places where, you know, an honest appraisal of something takes a kind of nuanced, complex discussion of things. Then you said it ends up, you know, not appealing to the people that are, I guess, left or right aside even, that people are just looking for really simple answers to things. Tell me, Rush Limbaugh is telling them, like, you know, what to think about in a very just direct and absolute way, and there's no room for any, this person's either a good person in politics or a bad person. They're not somebody, you know, that's doing a pretty good job, but maybe if we push them, they'll do a little bit better or something. It's just, people are written off as absolute. You can't just say, well, Obama's got some bad priorities. No, he's obviously a devil and socialist, and he's totally destroying America and everything it stands for. And I think there's a kind of a hunger out there, and that's kind of a scary thing, that the audience itself, it's not that they made that audience. That audience was sitting there waiting for this on some level, for someone who would come along and sort of speak to those kinds of things in absolutes and not be embarrassed to have a really simplistic idea about what's going on and say it boldly and laugh at the people who want to try and explain things as being complex or confusing or you know, nuanced or having two sides to an issue or something. So I think that's, I don't know how we address that. We're going to, before the end of this program, we'll be asking, what can we do about all this? But right now, I'll just say, I think part of the issue is like the audience for these programs, not necessarily just that the program itself has got these powers and does these things, but it's appealing to something that was sitting out there before the program came along.
Well, Rush Limbaugh had the name of his listeners. They call themselves Ditto Heads, which is, I'm just going to think what he thinks.
I'm proud of it.
Yeah,
Brian.
And
I'm proud of it.
Ditto Heads actually comes along. They coined that term because he doesn't like people calling up gushing about him. So they can say dittos or mega dittos, Rush. And that sort of says, I'm thrilled you're on the air. It's great that we have a voice. That's what that signifies. And one thing that's important to note is that these people are not puppets, you know, with the host as puppet masters. What they do is they take the values that they share with their audience. And I think Mike's absolutely right. You know, this is a soap opera. You've got heroes, you've got villains. There's no room for somebody in the middle, right? The soap opera characters, you don't get the guy who's like, well, sometimes he's a hero, sometimes he's a villain. You want good, you want bad. And they do this. They paint in broad brushstrokes, and they apply the values that they share with the audience to politics, to issues, to bills, to legislation that they might not otherwise hear about. And they help to shape opinion that way. And I think it's important to note that this is almost even more important today than it was in 1988 or 1990, because there is so much information out there that if you're someone who is, you know, we forget, especially people on social media forget, that the average American voter is not someone who's paying attention to every tweet on politics or watching every debate or watching, you know, the whole impeachment process. They're people who are more worried about, you know, what are the kids' lunches tomorrow? Who's driving carpool?
Who's going to win the Super Bowl?
Right, who's going to win the Super Bowl? And when they do tune in, it's very easy to be overwhelmed today because there's so much information, and it's all kind of, well, this guy's saying this, and this guy's saying this, and I have no idea who's right. So if you don't want to stick your head back in the sand, it's nice to have someone saying, well, let me simplify it for you. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. These are the guys who share your values, and you've listened to me for 20 years, and you know I share your values, so me vouching for them makes, you know, that's a gold standard. And that's part of what these hosts do, especially as media proliferates. And we have so much, you know, we're inundated with information and people's lives get busier. And so they do provide that kind of, you know, hey, this is the guy who I know. It's kind of like your brother-in-law who really loves politics. And we have, you know, go out to dinner with him and he says, well, you know, I've been following this for 6 months. This is what you should think. You kind of sigh with relief saying, okay, somebody's explaining this to me. What's going on here?
Well,
that's what these hosts do.
In our next segment, we're going to get into the keep, stop, starts. So hold those thoughts, Brian. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. We're listening to Dr. Brian Rosenwald, author of Talk Radio's America, How an Industry Took Over a Political Party That Took Over the United States. And in the studio is Mike Rotkin, 5-time mayor of the city of Santa Cruz and 6-term city council member. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And in these last few minutes, for our keep, stop, start portion of the program, what could listeners keep doing, stop doing, and start doing, Brian?
Well, what they should keep doing is there's been a rise in activism and awareness by people who are left-leaning over the last few years, since the election of Donald Trump. I think it hit a lot of people like a 2x4 over the head that this guy who they thought was totally buffoonish and unqualified and bigoted got elected. And, you know, one thing that I think has plagued people who are center or on the left side of the political spectrum is that traditionally in midterm elections, they don't vote. You see people say, well, you know, Merrick Garland should be on the Supreme Court. Well, what happened there was, if you look at the turnout in 2014 versus 2012, it really dipped off. And so I think that the people have to be engaged. As much as we're overwhelmed and inundated with political information, people have to stay engaged. They have to know what's going on because, you know, a lot of the damage done by conservative media to our our political debates is distortion, is misinformation. It's convincing Americans on the right that they have very little in common with their peers on the left, that in fact, you know, those people on the left, as Mike was saying, they're evil. They're not just, you know, good, to paraphrase John McCain in 2008 with that woman in the town hall meeting that went viral. They're not just, you know, good Christian Americans who disagree with them. They are evil. They're trying to drag America down and destroy American values. And, you know, the way that you combat that is for people to be informed and engaged and know what is being said and kind of spread a counter message and do it in carpool lines and do it in engagements. So I think it's very important that people stay engaged and informed and understand that you've got to vote in every election and understand that you have to talk about politics. You know, those old rules about, hey, you stay away from politics and religion at, you know, family dinners or nights out, I think we need to kind of eschew those a little bit. So I think that would be my keep. And I think my stop kind of relates to that, which is there is a tendency in today's politics, and some of what we've seen in conservative media, some of what I've been talking about, well, you better fight for the whole thing, you know, don't compromise, don't do this, don't do that, you know, or saying that the people who have been considered inside the political mainstream, with conservative media, they start deriding rhinos, Republicans in name only. And we're starting to see it with the Bernie Sanders forces, especially in the Democratic primary, where all of a sudden Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar, you know, people who were very comfortably in the mainstream of the Democratic Party for decades, are now, they're saying, well, they're not really liberals. And I think there's a danger in following Republicans down this kind of purity path that just further polarizes America. We should be willing to take a half a loaf that moves things in the directions that we want to go. And I think that we should be wary of those forces on the two poles that are trying to push us, trying to say, well, you've got to be pure, you've got to be perfect, or this person is bad. And understanding that there are shades of gray and that it's a very diverse country, and that we need to have respect for that diversity and understanding and try to find common ground instead of just driving people out. Because let's be honest, this is, you know, maybe a 52-48 country or 51-49. It's not 75-25 where either side can just ram things down the throat of the other one. And I think there's a real danger in thinking that we can do that. And so I think that avoiding purity and avoid voices that are calling for that and that are maligning people who, you know, agree with them on 70% of the issues is really problematic and dangerous. And I think we want to avoid that. And people need to be wary of those voices. And the things that I would say that people should be doing that they're not doing is we're finding more and more that we're living in echo chambers, that we're only consuming media that we agree with, that your average liberal may wake up and listen to community radio or NPR. They might flip on MSNBC at night. They're reading, you know, Huffington Post and other left-leaning sites, and listening to Pod Save America or things like that. And then your people on the right are waking up watching Fox and Friends with the president, since he seems to tune in an awful lot. They are listening to maybe the local conservative morning host on their AM station on their way to work. They might tune Limbaugh in during their lunch hour. They come home, they flip on Fox News. And if you've ever watched these three channels, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, at the same time, if you're in a gym or somewhere where they're all on, it's almost like we're on three different planets. They're not even talking about the same news, let alone, you know, being able to have a basis in fact where we can then debate about issues. And it's not just the media we consume, it's who we're living around, that we're living around the like-minded. We're living with people, you know, our neighbors all agree with us. And I think it's important that we talk to people who disagree, that we get our perceptions challenged and we challenge other people's perceptions. That instead of avoiding that conservative uncle you have, that you engage him, that you talk to him, you try. It may not work. You know, it may be that Uncle Ron or Uncle Ted is too far gone down that path to believe you. But I think we need to try. And I think we need to try to find common ground. And I think we need to be engaged. And this, to me, would be the recipe for kind of bringing the country in a positive, constructive direction.
Yeah, I think those are really good points, all the ones that you made. I know I'm one of the few people in this community on the left. And I was elected openly as a socialist feminist mayor in Santa Cruz. I mean, knowing that you can't create socialism in one town, but I mean, those were my politics. I didn't want to hide them from anybody. So it made it hard to red bait me because I'd already red baited myself. But the reality is that I would go on the conservative talk station in this town, you know, KSCO. It's a right wing station generally, and be invited by hosts. And they would invite me on, and I would go and talk. And I would try and make my arguments, ones that I thought might appeal to a conservative audience, at the same time not holding back from expressing what I thought we ought to be doing, or, and particularly when I was doing this when I was in elected office. But they would tell me, the host would tell me, well, I invited all kinds of people from the left to come on my program and stuff, and they all turn me down. They won't come here. And I go, well, I mean, if you never go and talk to people at all, this is a serious kind of a problem. And a lot of times I find this is a problem with my students, many of whom are like, UCSC's a fairly progressive campus. I have a lot of students who will definitely articulate a left politics, but they won't get into the details about it. So somebody will make a comment that they feel is racist, for example, and they'll say, well, that's a racist thing. They won't say why or try and explain to the person what it is about it that's inappropriate or whatever. They'll just write the person off. It's an absolute thing. And they're usually right. I mean, the person is making a racist comment, but you could explain that to a person in a way that they, maybe on the spot, they wouldn't agree with you, but they might go home and think about it or something. But the response they're getting from the person, the student that's, you know, telling them that they're racist is such that they're just going to get defensive, completely closed off, it was a wasted conversation. So a lot of times it's an issue of trying to think, well, maybe you really could persuade people. Think about what are their values. How could you persuade them about a particular issue in terms of how they've thought about the question in a way that might get them to change their mind? And the left has not been very good at that, unfortunately, I think. We're as closed-minded on some ways as the people. I like to believe that our values are better, and so the world we sort of project would be a better one to live in. But it doesn't mean that we do a good job of explaining to people why we think what we think or why what they're thinking is not correct or something. They just write them off. It's just a complete dismissal of somebody else's ideas. And that doesn't work well. And I think you're right. You're not always going to be successful at this, but you can be successful. We used to get calls into this right-wing radio station from people saying, well, I thought that guy Rotkin was crazy, but he made a really good point or something. And so it would be interesting to see that you're sometimes able to actually get through to people if you make an argument that does try to appeal to them on the basis of what you think they might believe about the world in general.
And Brian, I had just exactly the same experience when you were talking about being in a gym and there's the bank of all the TV on the walls. I saw on Fox News TV a banner not too long ago, and the banner said fake news versus Fox News. Now, you wouldn't see a banner like that on MSNBC or CNN, but the subliminal message is if you're not watching Fox, everything else is fake.
I think that's true, and I think a lot of what Mike said was right as well. You know, every Democratic politician, Mike, who I interviewed, who were frequent guests on talk radio, had very similar experiences, and they begged people in their party. They said, go on with these people. At the very worst, they will stop demonizing you, because they respect people who will come on and have a debate, and you're going to reach people, and there are some of your positions that they're going to like, and they very much had that experience. And I also think that when you talk about tolerance, this is something I've seen more and more with the campaign, is that the left isn't, you know, I too would like to think that the values are better, but that they're not any more tolerant of dissent than the right is.
And that Brian,
people, yeah.
I'm so sorry, we're running out of time and I want another hour with you.
I know, it always flies by so fast.
I know it does fly by, and I hope you'll come back. So I want to thank Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Dunham, and give another big thank you to you, and our in-studio guest, Mike Rotkin, and today's bold and oppressive guest, Dr. Brian Rosenwald. Thank you for writing your book, Brian, and you may find Talk Radio's America anywhere where fine books are sold. Next on Be Bold America, we will be discussing the national popular vote and swing left. We'll be talking with Scott Drexel, representing the national popular vote, and in the studio, will be Renee Block, who founded the Santa Cruz chapter of Swing Left. Don't miss it on Sunday, March 1st, 5 p.m. And find any previous programs in KSQD's archives or on my website, jillcodyauthor.com. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, Many Voices, One Station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Reflections on Buddhism. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.